I'd like to call the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee to order. Thank you, Representative Sanders. We do not quite have a quorum, so we will wait to move minutes. But Mr. Gardner, we appreciate you being here today. We will be reviewing our freight rail economic development study, and you are first up in the list. Thank you for being here.
Very good, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Bill Gardner. I'm director of the Freight Office at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And last week when we were here, we were talking about rail safety and some related issues. This week, we want to talk about a different topic that we think deserves attention, and that is rail, freight rail specifically, and economic development, how we can use rail as a catalyst for economic development. I know there's a number of speakers here today, so I'll try to be as efficient as possible. Just by way of a quick background, there are numerous both private and public benefits to using rail. Rail carries about one-third of all the freight tonnage that's moving in the state on an annual basis. We're currently in the process of updating our freight rail plan as well as our statewide freight plan, and our projections are now showing that we're going to experience up to a 40% increase in freight tonnage that's carried on the rail system between now and 2040. And really increasingly, a lot of that freight is moving across modes. It's being transferred between modes. So it's the connections between modes that are increasingly important. For example, freight rail service to our ports, some of our truck-to-rail facilities, and so forth. We have a number of industries that make extensive use of rail. A lot of the top producers in their category nationally are using rail. Either they've determined that that's the only economically viable option for them, or they've really looked at the range of options and determined that rail is best suited for them. We're ranked fourth nationally in terms of the freight on rail that originates in the state of Minnesota. So we're very much a railroad state. But we think that there's opportunities to grow not only the rail traffic, but the business activity, support the shippers in our state, the companies that are trying to move their goods and products. About 80% of the railroad track and about 90% of the tonnage is carried by the Class 1 railroads, the large railroads, the BNSF, the Canadian Pacific, the Union Pacific, and the Canadian National in that order. But it's really the 16 short line railroads, and you'll be hearing more about them from other speakers in particular, that provide connections to a lot of our communities in Minnesota, particularly in greater Minnesota. They're the ones that can really best serve small and medium-sized business because they offer carload service as opposed to the long hook and haul cross-country service. In some respects, the potential for economic growth is best along these short line railroads if some pieces of the puzzle come together. By way of illustration, you may be familiar with a flour mill in Rush City. It's been there for about 100 years, and they rely on a small railroad to bring them wheat into the facility to be milled, and then the outbound traffic is also carried by rail, the flour. About 5 years ago, a railroad bridge on that line had to be closed. You can see the photograph in the upper left-hand corner. The pier of that bridge was severely deteriorated, 100-year-old bridge. And as a result, the rail service had to stop. The flour mill had to make a decision. They looked at trucking as an alternative. They determined that wasn't economically viable. So they actually made the decision to close the plant. They laid off 40 employees. We work with some other agencies to try to find some funding to help that small railroad rebuild the bridge. We were able to secure that funding. They rebuilt the bridge within 6 months. The flour mill reopened. They rehired the employees, and they're operating very successfully today. So I think there's a couple of lessons learned from this experience. Certainly the connection, the nexus between transportation and business viability, the importance of infrastructure, condition, and capacity is another lesson learned. And finally, there's opportunities for public-private partnerships that can address some of the needs that we see out on the freight rail system. The FRED project, Freight Rail Economic Development Project, really began as a discussion a couple of years ago. That was a discussion between the DOT, between DEED, Department of Employment and Economic Development, the railroads, and some of our legislative leadership, including Representative Beard, who you'll be hearing from in a few minutes, to look at ways that we can make rail service more attractive, ways that we can increase access for our shippers to that rail service, and ways that ultimately we can increase the utilization of rail. And it's really based on the rationale that if we can have more shipping by rail, those companies will lower their transportation costs, they'll be more competitive within their industry cluster, and ultimately better able to retain and possibly expand their job base. The FRED project involves some really terrific original research and technical analysis. DEED and MnDOT co-managed the project. We had a terrific consulting team, some of whom are in the audience today, so if I get in trouble on some technical questions. All that research is posted on the website. You have a copy of the final report here, which is a very condensed version of the full final report, and I would certainly encourage you to take a look at it when you have a chance. But I want to focus really on one dimension of the work that was done, and that was some of the outreach that we did with a variety of stakeholders. We talked with industrial real estate developers to better understand how they use transportation considerations and access to industrial sites as considerations for businesses that want to relocate and expand. And you know, I think that affirmed our understanding of that connection. We had a lot of discussions with the railroads, particularly the small railroads, and I think we were surprised, frankly, by the wide range of capacity in terms of their marketing ability, the way they attract new business. The smallest railroads, those folks are railroad people. They're busy, they're consumed trying to run their railroads, take care of their infrastructure, and it's a challenge for them to attract additional business. We talked a lot with shippers. Again, those are the companies that are trying to move their raw materials and goods, both those who use rail currently and those who don't use rail, who've never used it. And the ones who haven't used rail, by and large, don't understand the benefits of rail. They don't know how to access it. They don't know if it's suitable for their company. They don't know what the requirements of the railroad might be. They don't know who to call to find out, get more information. So that was a bit of an eye-opener. We had a lot of conversations with the economic development community, particularly at the local level. And for the most part, rail is not in their lexicon. It's not on their radar. And finally, we had a lot of discussions with our peer states. We talked to 15 or 16 other states that administer rail assistance programs or are involved in rail development activities. And I think we realized that there are some important tools in the toolboxes those other states have that we don't have that would make us more effective with our programs. So in terms of findings, sort of in conclusion, a number of points here. And other speakers will be talking about this first one, but improving the quality of our short line infrastructure. There's definitely some short line railroads that are missing out on business opportunities because they do not have industry grade, industry standard track or bridges. They can't carry the weight of rail cars. They can't operate at the speeds that they need to be competitive. We need to improve our access to intermodal container service. Right now, there's a couple of big container yards in the Twin Cities that two of our large railroads manage. Containers really now are sort of the international currency by which freight moves. So if a company is interested in export, moving, for example, identity-preserved grain or even manufactured products, they have to use a container. So if a company is located in northern Minnesota, they actually have to pay to truck a full container down here to the Twin Cities and then to pay to have an empty container trucked back for their usage. That adds significantly to the cost of a number of our shippers, the transportation costs, and makes them less competitive. We need to find ways to extend that intermodal access to greater Minnesota, perhaps using short lines as feeders to the larger railroads. We need to address the gap in knowledge with our economic development community and our shipper community about rail. And so as part of this project, we actually developed a rail toolkit, which is a terrific resource. This is on the website if you want to take a look at it. That allows the business to do sort of a pro forma evaluation of whether rail would be suitable for their business, explains the benefits, how to access rail, who to contact, maps, so on and so forth. It's a great resource. We also worked with Deed to change their database system. They maintain a very large database of available industrial properties in the state. But there was really no way to break out rail-served properties specifically. They've gotten that done now. And finally, we're still trying to figure out what can be an ongoing forum for all of these different entities to work together to kind of have a consistent conversation about rail and economic development, more at a strategic level. That could be a committee, it could be a conference on an annual basis, it could be some sort of a forum. There are some specific changes to the programs that MnDOT administers we think we need to make. In some cases, we have made them. Traditionally, we've capped our loan limits on the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, which is a revolving loan fund that's been around for about 30 years and has really helped to stabilize the short line industry. It's also available to rail shippers for things like rail equipment, rail loading equipment. Traditionally, we've had a $200,000 cap. Well, that bridge in Rush City I talked to you about that needed rebuilding cost $750,000 to rebuild. $200,000 doesn't buy you much anymore. So there's some complications with state rules, but we've looked at that and we've now lifted those loan limits, assuming there's adequate collateral available. Most of the other states that have revolving loan programs also have grant components to the programs, typically requiring maybe a 50% match. But the more important point is that they're tied specifically to job creation. They may offer loan forgiveness, and we think this would help to incent some really good projects, again, with the end result of increasing jobs. We think we need to do a little bit better job on our cost-benefit analysis. And some of the other states have developed some excellent tools to do that, to better define some of the both public and private benefits from these projects. We think the program should be available in certain emergencies. The small railroads have difficulty having enough insurance to actually cover things like a washed out track section, a bridge that burns down, so forth, in a natural disaster. And finally, we're doing a lot of on the ground work with cities and counties and other public entities trying to improve rail service in their communities. For example, extending a rail spur into an industrial park. And a lot of times they don't have the resource and we don't have an available resource to do the upfront planning that's needed, to do the feasibility analysis, to do the environmental work, sometimes preliminary engineering. We think the program ought to be eligible for that kind of activity. And finally, and then I'll stop, MnDOT administers something called the Transportation Economic Development Program in coordination with Deed. This has always been a highway program based on a cost-benefit analysis. A way to accelerate highway projects requires a local match. Very successful program, a lot of demand for the program. But there's a number of other states that operate multimodal transportation economic development programs, much like the federal TIGER program, where a cost-benefit analysis determines where that money goes. So the project, regardless of mode, receives funding. And in some cases, we have projects that have multiple modes of transportation that need to be improved. Again, for example, rail service into a port. You might need port improvements. You might need rail improvements. And it's very, very difficult to cobble together different flavors of funding with all of their various restrictions to make a project work. So the study recommends a multimodal TED program. I'm going to stop there. This is the URL for the project. Here are the contacts for the project managers, unfortunately neither of whom could be here today. But I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, or we can move on to the additional speakers.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. We do have a question from Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Just a couple of questions. On page 11, you talk about the energy efficiency of freight rail, and which is impressive. I know that the rail industry runs a commercial about this on television. Has anyone, you looked at one ton of freight on a single gallon of fuel. Has anyone done any comparative studies of rail versus other modes of transportation in terms of greenhouse gas emissions? Are you aware of that? Is there data on that?
Mr. Gardner.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein. Yes, there has been research on that. I've seen that research from EPA and others, and I'm trying to recall the rankings. I believe waterway transportation, ultimately, if you look on a per ton miles basis, produces the lowest gas house green emissions and is sort of the overall the most energy efficient, but rail is right behind them as well.
Okay. Well, I'll look for that, but if if you have that or could provide that, that would be great. And then, Mr. Chair, just another question. On page 22, under other funding strategies, I see a lot of tax credits. I see a lot of using tax policy to support the industry. And, you know, I know that, you know, at one time our freight railroads were struggling. Now I understand it's a highly profitable industry. And I'm just concerned, maybe Representative Drazkowski might be with me on this one. I'm concerned when we use tax policy and subsidy for successful industries. Is that a good use of public dollars? I see tax credits for rehab, tax credits for shippers, state rail property taxes to rail investment purposes, et cetera. How much money are we talking about in terms of, you know, how much would these recommendations cost? If we're shifting all of this, I would assume general fund money towards what in effect would be a subsidy to the industry.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I don't have a figure on behind those ideas. As I mentioned, we are updating our state rail plan, so we will have some information about needed costs and infrastructure improvements and so forth. I did want to mention that there has been for quite some time a federal tax credit targeted to the short lines, and that's something that some states have also replicated at the state level, and perhaps our railroad speaker who is following me can address that one in more detail.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, this issue has sort of surfaced because I know we're talking about a much broader thing than just oil train traffic today, but, you know, I think there's some interest in, looking at a more proportional cost-sharing plan, you know, with railroads in terms of these infrastructure improvements. So it's not so heavily reliant on public money. And my last question, Mr. Chair, would be: do we have any current data around how much, in a sense, subsidy, public subsidy, at least from the state, we're giving to the rail industry? Is there any figure or any data on that? If you were to combine all the different, whether it's TED money or DEED or MnDOT, et cetera, do we have those figures at all anywhere?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I think part of the findings of the study is that rail is not a part of many of the existing transportation initiatives and programs because it's primarily owned by the private sector. Yeah. We've suggested some partnership opportunities, but currently there is no money in the TED program that's available for rail needs, for example.
But you just have a recommendation to possibly look at that.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Now we have, I'm sorry, Mr. Gardner, we have one more question, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gardner, for your presentation. I'm in the low chair here today. It's if you can't see me, I'm over here. So, Mr. Gardner, I don't see additional taxes in here. Were additional taxes part of the recommendations in the report?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, this study was not targeted towards funding recommendations or tax policy and so forth. It talks about potential opportunities in a variety of areas to address needs that are there, but really it's more about strategies of connecting shippers towards improved rail service with an outcome of improving economic development.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gardner. So, Mr. Gardner, the governor's proposal to expand the property tax on railroads would, in your opinion, is that something that will help us get there faster, or will it slow us down?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware that particular proposal will be targeted towards addressing rail needs specifically. So to the extent that we're talking about rail needs in this report, I don't think that is part of the equation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Gardner. Now we'll hear from...
pardon me?
Oh, okay. Yes, thank you, Mr. Gardner. And if we could move the minutes. Representative Sanders, did you have a chance to review the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Sanders moves the minutes of Monday. January 26th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Those minutes are approved. And now we have Ms. Werner from the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Good afternoon, Ms. Werner. And members, we do have their study in your in the PowerPoint in your folders. Ms. Werner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Marnie Werner, and I'm the research director at the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and I'm located in Mankato, Minnesota. And we were created by the legislature in 1997 with the purpose of doing research on issues important to rural Minnesota that need to be communicated to the state legislature, and so we've been working on that ever since. And so this year I was asked to do research on freight rail in Minnesota. I was asked specifically to look into what were the causes of the delays of last winter. And when I started looking into that, we found that there were it was a much more far-reaching story than that. And so in the article that you have received, there is a discussion of the delays, but then we also talk about the importance of freight rail in greater Minnesota and to the industries that are there. And so there was a handout with PowerPoint slides on it, and I apologize for not bringing the actual presentation because it didn't occur to me this would be in black and white and that it's also color dependent. But we'll just run through this quickly and take any questions anyone might have. So the freight rail handout is the one with the PowerPoint slides, freight rail in greater Minnesota. And if you want to look at that one, no, we don't have that up. On the second slide, there's a map of the country that shows which states are more dependent on rail than average. And those are, of course, the Midwest states. They're the states in the middle that would be green if you could see this in color. And these are obviously the states that don't have ports. And so a large amount of their freight is actually passed or is actually transported via rail. And so on slide number 3, on the next page, we see what Minnesota ships by rail, and we have the little pie chart there, and we can see that the largest amount by tonnage is metallic ores, which is, of course, taconite from up on the Iron Range, and we were first in the nation in the amount of that. Farm products, of course, food products, including things like soybean meal, corn syrup, and then stone, sand, and gravel. And you can see that we are large shippers of that compared to other states. And the thing that we wanted to point out with this is that these are our top products that are shipped by freight rail. And these are also all products that come from greater Minnesota. They originate in rural areas. And so you can see that freight rail is used, and it's a significant means of transport. It is a cost-effective means of transport for the industries in greater Minnesota. On the next slide, you can see that Minnesota is well-connected. It's not the greatest map to be able to look at, but you can see the extent of the rail network in the nation.
Can I ask you to speak a little closer to the microphone?
Sure.
I think we're having a little trouble there. Thank you.
Try this. Okay. And so you can see that the rail network gives us connections to across the U.S., into Canada, down to Mexico, also to the West Coast and East Coast ports. In the last few years, a lot of our grain from Minnesota has shifted from going to East Coast, to the East Coast via Duluth, to going West Coast, to the West Coast, out to China. China and Asia have become significant customers of our agricultural products there. And so that's just a quick overview of the importance of freight rail to greater Minnesota. And so then I wanted to just shift into another piece in the article, and that is to talk about the short line railroads and the purpose that they serve. As you can see on slide number 5, The map of on the left shows the Class 1 lines. These are the largest rail lines, the Burlington Northern, the Canadian Pacific, Union Pacific, Canadian National. These are the large Class 1 lines that run through the state. The second slide next to it shows where the short line railroads then fill in. They serve a purpose like the state highways and county roads do to the interstate highways. They connect the places that are between the large Class 1 lines and interconnect into those Class 1 lines to provide efficient shipping to those connections. This way, the producers don't necessarily need to depend on trucks if they don't want to. This gives them an option, which helps with transportation costs. There was a question before about tax subsidies and funding for railroads and should we be doing this for profitable companies. I'm not familiar with very many of the tax subsidies and the programs that are out there to assist these programs, but I would say that there is a difference in railroad companies as to what's profitable and what's not profitable. The large Class 1 lines are profitable. These are the Burlington Northerns, the Canadian Nationals, the Union Pacifics. I think BNSF cleared $35 billion this year in profits. And ironically, though, this is one of the first years that it has actually turned a profit. The short lines, on the other hand, these are the small railroad companies, the largest of which is the Twin Cities and Western Rail Line, which runs from the South Dakota border into the Twin Cities. They're much smaller. They're like the small towns compared to Minneapolis or St. Paul. And some of them are doing quite well, like Twin Cities and Western. They're doing a good business. They can connect farmers in the center part of the state into the Twin Cities, where they can then connect with the other four rail lines and get those goods for Minnesota producers out to basically anywhere in the world. Some of the smaller lines, though, are having a lot of trouble with their infrastructure. They make enough money to stay profitable and to operate, but they don't have enough capital to be able to improve their very capital-intensive infrastructure. One figure I was told was that it costs $1 million a mile to upgrade or to just install a railroad line. And then there are the shippers that also use the railroad lines that need facilities that are able to handle freight rail. One of the problems that short lines are seeing is that Class 1 lines are moving to heavier, larger cars that can handle more weight. They're going from approximately 200,000 tons per car to tons or pounds, I'm not quite sure which, to 300 and some thousand in weight, so much larger cars. The rail lines need to be improved, and this is part of what BNSF is doing when they talk about the improvements they're doing. They're fortifying their lines to be able to handle this heavier equipment. Short lines need to be able to handle those cars, too, if they're going to be able to link in with the Class 1 lines, and so they need to be able to upgrade their lines. Right now, some of the rail lines are in such bad conditions that the speed limits are set at 5 or 10 miles an hour, and they have to creep along their lines because of that. So it's not a very efficient way to be doing business. It's not necessarily a great transportation option. It could be better, and they would like it to be better. And so one thing I just wanted to point out that we talked about in the article, and you can see in the recommendations there, is there's a discussion of the short lines in the second recommendation, and then the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program. I interviewed several people for this article, and when I asked them what the state could do to help rail in Minnesota and help it be viable, they said, do something about the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program. Now, I heard that Mr. Gardner said that they've increased the caps. That was the main thing, because the loans were capped at $200,000, which isn't really enough to do anything with rail anymore. This program does work for rail, though. It also works for the shippers to help them improve their facilities so they can handle these new larger trains that the Class 1 railroads would like to be using. And the more options that shippers have, the more control they have over their transportation costs and the more chance they have to be competitive. A lot of what Greater Minnesota produces is commodities, and the definition of a commodity is that it's a lot like another commodity of the same kind. And so any kind of overhead cost increases the price and puts it in direct competition with another seller. And so whatever can be done to help these producers keep their commodities competitive would help Greater Minnesota.
Thank you. Any questions for members? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for testifying today. I appreciate the information and so forth. Going back to slide 3, which talks about, the heading says, what Minnesota ships by rail. From the topic, it would indicate that this is products that originate in Minnesota. Is that correct?
That is correct.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Petersburg.
Do you have any kind of statistics as to what is shipped across the state, specifically oil in this case? Because I'm guessing it's going to be up numbers like that as well.
Right.
Ms. Werner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The data where this data comes from is from the American Association of Railroads. And they give data based on what originates in a state and what terminates in a state, but they don't give data on what actually passes through the state. Now, I know that MnDOT does have data on how much crude goes through the state, and I can't think of the number off the top of my head, but I believe it is somewhere in the area of 7 to 8 trains a day. I'm not sure what that totals out at, but I think MnDOT has a better idea of what that is.
Thank you. We'll probably hear from another testifier about that question. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Werner, one question, just clarifying. You had mentioned a profit level for one of the Class 1 railroads. What was that you stated?
Well, this was what I heard on NPR a couple weeks ago, and that was $35 billion.
By who?
Burlington Northern. Okay. But it should probably be checked.
Okay, yeah. I think we may need some clarification on that. Do you have a question on that specifically or an answer to that specifically? We would like to clarify that. So please state your name for the committee.
Hi, I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company. Our 2013 net income for the railroad was $3.8 billion, not $38.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify your comment about the recommendation relative to the Mercy program. So you said Mr. Gardner said they have lifted the caps, but are you saying that recommendation has now been taken care of? Are you still suggesting, or does the report still suggest more change on that? And if so, do they make a recommendation about whose responsibility it is to generate those changes?
At the time I wrote this article, there were a lot of changes going on, and so lifting the caps was one of the things that happened around that time, and I probably missed it. Given the conversations that I had with people, I would recommend looking at the program, and it may be suitable now, or MnDOT may want to take a different direction with this. But I would recommend, suggest reviewing the program. I wouldn't say that it's all fixed.
And just to clarify that,
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, so does the report recommend MnDOT generate some further changes? I'm just wondering if it's not clear whose responsibility it is, maybe it doesn't happen. So does the report, when they make those recommendations, do they say MnDOT should?
Ms. Werner.
I think MnDOT could if they wanted to. I think it could be whoever feels the need to. Now that the caps have been raised, it may be at a good point to be more helpful for short lines now.
Thank you, Ms. Werner. Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Werner, I was speaking to someone this morning about railroads, and I'm learning more about them, but they categorized them as utilities. In all of your work and research, have you ever run across anybody, any company, any agency that has referred to railroads as utilities?
Ms. Werner.
No, I haven't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Johnson, we'll take you the last question. We do have to keep moving here. We have a number of testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Werner. Evidently, you spoke with a lot of folks that involved the short line industry. Did you learn of any kind of creative private partnerships where there's investment shared in some fashion or with larger railroads as well to improve the railroad bed and the track itself?
Ms. Werner.
I did not, but that doesn't mean there isn't something out there.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony today. We appreciate you being here at the committee.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from Mr. Wagner, President of the Twin Cities and Western Railroad Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Mark Wagner, President of the Twin City and Western Railroad and the Minnesota Prairie Line Railroad. In your packet, you have a map. We are the rail lines that are located pretty much due west, southwest of the Twin Cities. In terms of economic development, the rail line shown on the map called MPLI, that is a rail line that the five counties it runs through own. They purchased it from the Chicago Northwestern Railway in 1981 to prevent it from being torn up. It was run by various rail operators for the next 18 years, and it became so bad that it became known as the line of the standing derailment. Literally, cars would lean over and then derail. The five counties in 2000 took back the rail line, worked with Minnesota Department of Transportation, the shippers along the rail line, and TC&W to put $6 million into the line to get it back to a solid 10-mile-an-hour operation. That rehabilitation was completed in 2002. The long-term goal of getting that rail line in such a shape where it can be an ongoing entity for the foreseeable future would be to get it up to a 25-mile-an-hour, 286 gross pound-on-rail capacity. I'm happy to say that 11 years later, the first 34 miles to Winthrop are now 25 miles an hour, and hopefully by midsummer will be. There's one bridge that needs to be upgraded that should be done by this summer, and then it will be that segment will be 286,000 pounds. Well, what has that meant? What that's meant is that in anticipation of this, the ethanol plant in Winthrop tripled from a 33 million gallon plant to a 100 million gallon plant. That ethanol has been shipped from Minnesota to New York City and New England area to alleviate their MBTEs that were poisoning the ground. So Minnesota ethanol is being shipped to New England to have clean air, and it's worked quite well. There's over 900 farmers in that cooperative. There is a farmers cooperative right next door to the ethanol plant. They built a state-of-the-art fertilizer distribution center. So we can bring trains in that originate on the Gulf Coast, come all the way up to Minnesota, and we bring them out there, and they're unloaded, and it provides Minnesota farmers an economic fertilizer source. In addition, there is a dairy processing facility in Winthrop that brings in frozen butter from California, does something to that butter, and then sends out whatever they do with that butter down to Mexico. And I'm told they're one of the two or three plants in the country that do whatever it is they do. They, too, have invested in their facilities. And then, so with all this rail-centric activity in Winthrop, a non-rail seed distribution company also decided to locate in Winthrop. So the town of Winthrop today is much different than the town of Winthrop in 2000, and in fact Winthrop has the lowest property tax base in Sibley County. I think there might be a correlation there. We have been working with our various elected officials as well as the Rail Authority and the shippers to continue that momentum to improve the rail line west of Winthrop. The shippers west of Winthrop are hopeful of that, and their hope is being expressed in investment. In Moreton, Minnesota, which is 38 miles west, the shipper there put two 750,000 bushel bins right adjacent to the existing rail line. They can't use that rail until it gets to the 286 gross pound on rail. So somewhere in this legislative session or next, you will see the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority, the owners of the rail line, consisting of the five counties, submitting a bonding request asking for that, because these shippers are making these investments which are adding jobs in that part of the state. And further west, you get into Yellow Medicine County, and it's not exactly Prosperity Central. They really appreciate what rail economics do. So you've got Echo and Delhi. Of course, those are Minnesota common names, right? And then as a kind of a not foreseen in 2000 when this was completed, but now, if you remember, the winter previously, there was this propane shortage. And the propane shortage was exacerbated by the Cochin pipeline being reversed, but also the very wet harvest. And so we have propane people that are looking for areas to distribute propane in that part of Minnesota. And they are looking specifically east of Winthrop because that segment of the rail line can handle the propane. On the TC&W, they already are distributing propane, or they opened one up in Montevideo, Minnesota. So our purpose, we're a short line railroad, Twin City and Western Minnesota Prairie Line. Our purpose is to grow the economies of the areas we serve, plain and simple. And the only way we do that is, one, we give superior shipper service, but two, we make sure that our infrastructure is maintained. Representative Hornstein, you raised the question about the tax credit. The tax credit, as the short line tax credit, which is a federal tax credit, requires the short line to spend $3,500 per track mile in order to get that credit. And the credit is basically you get 50% of that back. What's the practical effect for us, TC&W? TC&W was formed in 1991. After the Milwaukee Road had gone bankrupt, and then the Soo Line owned it for 6 years, and they couldn't see a future in it. So we did, but it was 100,000 ties behind. The traffic that TC&W generates only allowed to put in about 14,000 ties a year. Well, with this tax credit, we're able to amp that up to 21,000 ties a year. And I'm happy to say that within about 2-3 years from now, assuming that tax credit is still in play, we should be caught up on the ties, which is great. But the other thing on TC&W is it's 144 miles, 139 of the miles, the rails are jointed. You need to have welded rail in order to long-term operate all of this freight. And then the reality of short line railroads is that 70% of our costs are fixed, that is, the cost of maintaining the infrastructure. Only 30% of the costs are variable, the cost of running the trains. With the large railroads, the economics are flip-flopped. 70% of their costs are variable running the trains, and that's because they have so much volume. And then 30% of it is to maintain their tracks. Now, to put in perspective with BNSF, last year they invested $5.5 billion in their system, and this year they're going to invest $6 billion in their system. And we all know that the issues that were had last winter, but you had the perfect storm of not only bad winter, but record grain crop, especially in the Dakotas where they're switching from wheat to corn soybeans. You're going from 40 bushel acre to 160 bushel acre, so you're immediately quadrupling the volume demand. Then you had the power plants wanting coal, and then, of course, the rise of crude out of Bakken. And so you react to that, the railroads are reacting to that, but as I've told people, it's like adding a second drain to Lake Superior. It's not going to drain overnight. Likewise, when they throw all this capital into their system, it's not going to get fixed overnight. It affects us because we go into the Twin Cities. We interchange in St. Paul every day, and so we're waiting in line just as well with all the other trains waiting in line to get in and out of St. Paul. But long term, this is a very good thing for Minnesota because our rural communities have access to our system. They have shipped to 44 United States, 6 Canadian provinces, and 4 Mexican states. So rural Minnesota is truly international, and that's just representing our short line. So I just wanted to share that, one, we appreciate very much your support of our industry, and again, our mission is to grow the economies of the areas we serve, which I think helps all Minnesotans, not only by the increased taxes that prosperity brings in by all of the businesses and farmers, but also that we save on the wear and tear on the roads and hopefully alleviate some of the congestion in the Twin Cities area by bringing this freight in via rail versus truck. So that's about it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wagner. We appreciate being here at the committee. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, my concerns are mainly around the larger railroads in terms of the tax credits. But I just wanted to ask you, Mr. Wagner, how many trains do you currently run in and out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, per day at this point?
Until the beginning of harvest, it was about average 4 a day. Right now, we're down to 3 a day. And I would anticipate that remaining so until probably May, June, and then that may increase again to 4 a day.
Now, is that in both directions or one direction?
That's both directions.
Okay. And then, thank you, just a quick follow-up. And then when you are looking out into the future, do you see that number being stable, or are you anticipating growth over that 3 or 4 trains a day, depending on the time of year?
Mr. Wagner.
I would say it's long-term growth, and I would call it, it's not dramatic growth, but for instance, we have a facility in Appleton, Minnesota, that's investing $20 million in a new facility, which will open up in July. That may add 18 trains a year. So, you know, it sounds like a lot, but when you divide 18 trains a year into 12 months, you know, you're talking maybe 1 or 2 trains additional a month.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wagner. We are going to move on to our next testifier. Thank you very much. We welcome Representative, now Commissioner Beard. Welcome to your committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was my committee, and I was happy to share it with your loyal critic, Representative Hornstein, but it's nice to be back. For the record, I'm Mike Beard, 8434 Horizon Drive, Shakopee, Minnesota. At the moment, I'm representing myself, but in the interest of full disclosure, as soon as campaign finance issues me my lobbyist registration number, I will be representing the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Shippers Association as they come back to you and talk about bonding to help the counties rebuild their infrastructure. Perhaps more about this in a minute. Mr. Chairman, I did get the cue that you wanted to wrap this up so we can talk about my other favorite subject, which would be airports. I'll be sitting right over there if you need comment on that, Mr. Chairman. But let me just give you a little overview, members, about this whole FRED report, which is kind of what we're showcasing here today. Back when the Staggers Rail Act was passed and the interstate commerce, or the railroads, were pretty much freed from the iron grip of the ICC, they could actually begin to justify their systems, set their rates, negotiate directly with their shippers for better business profitability. There's a concept. And they could begin to spin off rail lines that were deemed redundant or duplicative. And so we began to have abandonments all over the place. The Minnesota Prairie Line was one of those. In fact, Minnesota lost a lot of branch lines. Perhaps some of those were in your hometowns. And that was having quite an impact on the rural economies as elevators were forced to consolidate and economies of scale took place. Probably should have happened anyhow and would have happened in a normal market. But once the ICC was taken away from the railroads, that kind of oversight, they were actually free to justify their system. About that time, the regional rail authorities were formed. I think the legislature gave authority to counties to do joint powers boards to form rail authorities. I think every metro county has a rail authority, which preserves some corridors, some of which are one of my other favorite subjects, light rail lines today. But the ones I'm most fond of and enthusiastic about are the the freight lines in greater Minnesota. As far as I know, Mr. Chairman, there's only two of them that are publicly owned. The one down in Rock and Nobles County is a joint effort. They bought that line to save several small towns like Laverne and Buffalo Creek, and, of course, the five counties running through Winthrop and Redwood Falls out to Hanley Falls bought their rail line, 94 miles of it, because they knew what would happen to their towns if they lost their rail service, particularly their freight rail service. So for every few years, we had people coming in, some of our former colleagues like Representative Morrow, carrying a bill. I always signed on to those bills, looking for a few million here, a few million there, to rebuild that really decrepit infrastructure and try to give the towns out there the ability to reinvest and to grow, like you heard about Winthrop, and you're going to hear shortly about Gibbon and some other things that are going on out there. But one of the things we were always looking at was, you know, where do we get hard numbers to show that this actually makes sense to bond the entire state of Minnesota for a handful of million dollars? What kind of regional impact does it have? So back, I think, in 2012, I think the department and a couple of the lobbyists brought this committee a bill for the FRED study. So we could actually get, we could actually accurately quantify and describe what was happening with the dollars that were invested and what would happen to these towns if they lost a rail authority. What does this railroad business actually mean to greater Minnesota? I was delighted to see the Center for Rural Policy actually jumped on and did their own report. I know there's been some interest at the Humphrey Institute about some of this stuff. So I just want to applaud you for receiving this report, hearing this discussion today. Mr. Chairman, there is a, I think the report does underscore the point that there is a vibrancy and a viability in our rural communities that actually is preserved and enhanced when they can defend and protect and improve their local freight rail service. There are people that need to do big things, and that requires railroads to do that. Every extra penny per bushel that can stay on the farm and can stay at the local co-op or the local elevator is money that stays in that town for buying new pickup trucks or going out to dinner or making a donation to their church fund. Mr. Chairman, I guess that's about what I have to say. I've got a lot more here, but I see you looking at the clock, and we do want to hear from the airports. But if you have a few questions, I'd be happy to stand for them.
Thank you, Commissioner.
If you wish.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See, we learned in tax committee today that the possibility that the railroads may not be paying their fair share of property taxes. Is there any reason for that, that they should be doing that?
Mr. Beard.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the railroads are private property that are actually, they're not public utilities, they're common carriers engaged in interstate commerce. They do pay actually $38, $40 million a year in property taxes to the local jurisdictions for a host of services, some of which they actually provide. I'm thinking of the stormwater utility fee where most of the railroads that built the towns that built around them actually provide the runoff service for the local streets, so on. Fair is a political term, Mr. Chairman, I would submit. What is a fair share and what do they do? But you'll notice just a few moments ago I referred to every extra penny per bushel that stays in the local economy stays in the local economy and that town benefits. So if we end up taking more out of the local railroads, I guess you've got to weigh the benefit of running a dollar through St. Paul, and how is that more valuable than just leaving it there in the first place to be spent at Ethel's Donut Shop or the local implement dealer? I guess that's my response to that.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Beard, you're a pretty good student of this stuff. Could you comment? I believe in Europe, the government owns all the rail lines, and then the private industries own the cars. I mean, does that work, and is that anything that we think makes more sense than the way we do it here, especially for the small short lines?
Commissioner Beard.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I cannot speak to with any degree of precision to what Europe does, but that is a great segue to one thing I was going to leave on the cutting room floor, but let me bring it up. South Dakota, whenever they lost their entire, were facing losing their entire rail infrastructure back in the late 70s, actually levied a temporary surcharge on their sales tax and bought the entire Milwaukee system and then turned around and resold it to the Burlington Northern. Wisconsin, they actually, when this was all happening to them in the late 70s and early 80s, they made a bipartisan decision that their state was going to buy the real estate underneath the rail line. So the state actually holds it, And then they would allow the counties to form joint powers agreements to buy the steel and the ties and the bridge structures on top of the real estate. And then those regional rail authorities that own the steel could then contract with short line operators to operate the trains on top of that. That's the Wisconsin model. Just their last biennium, Governor Walker was pushing for a $90 million investment in that program. The legislature cut him back to $60 million that they actually put in to their rail bed and bridge improvement program because the state owns the right-of-way, the counties own the steel, and they contract with three or four different operators to actually operate the short lines on top of that. Way different than Minnesota did it, which was basically to give the counties the authority if they wished and then kept our hands off.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I knew you'd have a great answer. Thanks.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here at our committee, Commissioner. And
Mr. Chairman, thank you for letting me come back. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. We will now have Ms. Isaacson, Director at MnDOT of the Aeronautics Office. Welcome, Ms. Isaacson. I believe we have your PowerPoint in our folders as well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Cassandra Isaacson. I'm the Director of Aeronautics for MnDOT, and I do have a few slides to run through with you, and I'd be happy to answer questions as we go if there are any questions that these slides generate.
Certainly. Thank you. Please proceed.
So to begin with, just a little bit of history. I know that Commissioner Zelli was here earlier this week and told you a little bit about the history of MnDOT. Aeronautics has been around in some form since the 1930s. We were an agency for a long time. In the 70s, we were consolidated under the DOT. There's still an entire chapter of state law dedicated to aviation and airports. It's Chapter 360. Most folks, when they think of MnDOT, they think of infrastructure, and we absolutely do have a role in infrastructure, but we have a broader role in aviation. So I like to tell folks, if you're in aviation in Minnesota, we're interested. FAA has four business lines. We interact with three out of those four. The one that we don't interact with is commercial space travel. Not really at the right latitude for that, but you never know. One day that might be coming along too. So.
Oh God! Now they're going to expand the airport.
What do we do at the state level? We collect aviation taxes, so aircraft registration, sales tax, some of those kinds of things. We have a statewide planning role for aviation, so we work with all the airports in the state to have a coordinated state system. We distribute both state and federal dollars to the airports. We actually, the state of Minnesota owns some of the navigational and weather systems that are used by pilots as they're flying through the state. We enforce state and federal safety standards. We have some work that FAA delegates to us that we do on their behalf. We also provide technical resources to local government, and we have an educational function providing safety training, pilot training, training of airport personnel, that sort of thing. Just sort of a overview of aviation in Minnesota. We have what we call 135 public airports. So those are airports that are publicly owned and open to the public. Of those 135, nine currently have airline service. All of the rest of the airports are just your typical city, county airport. Most of the airports in the state, then there's three kinds of ownership. It's typically city-owned, county-owned, or an airport authority. Airport authority is generally created at the local level between city and county governments to own the airport. Also, there's the Metropolitan Airports Commission, whom you'll hear from later. They're also an airport authority. They're just created at the state level versus at a local level. Of those 135 airports that the state provides funding to, 92 of them are fully eligible for federal funding. There's an additional five that are partially eligible. So they're on what is called the NPAAS, the National Plan of Airports. And so they receive federal money. We recently completed our state aviation system plan. This is a broad look at aviation in the state. We inventoried all of the airports. We have a performance measures and outcomes that we monitor. This helps guide the selection of projects, those kinds of things. It complies with federal law that requires that we periodically do this and take a look. In this inventory, you'll find a condition assessment of each airport in the state, things like pavement condition, but also the facilities they have available. And we looked at, you'll see later in my presentation, we have some information on what some of the needs are for that infrastructure, that sort of thing. The State Airports Fund, which we manage, it's about $20 million per year. There's several sources of revenue that go into that fund. There's aviation fuel tax, aircraft sales and use tax, airline flight property tax, aircraft registration tax, and then there's a few other taxes and fees. So basically, this is taxing the users of the aviation system, and then this money goes back out into the aviation system. It's sort of a nice little closed bubble within MnDOT. We have pretty good defined edges. We work really hard to on keeping track of all of that. But so all the aviation money that's used at not only the state or airports fund, but when I talk to you about the federal money, that is also from aviation users. And so at the local level, most airports have some local participation that they use for their airports. We have a classification system, so just like when you think about roads, there's interstates and there's township roads, city roads, there's sort of a hierarchy, if you will. In Minnesota, we have three kinds of airports: key, intermediate, and landing strip. The key airports are the larger airports. There's 30 of those. State law gives us the size of the system, and so as you can see, we're currently smaller than what's allowed. The system has been reducing in size over time. There are fewer airports now than there were in the past. The key airports tend to be those that are near the larger population centers. It's not just the ones that have airline service, but airports such as Wilmer, Mankato, some of the larger communities. Those are the airports. Business jets can land there, major cargo carriers, airlines as well. The intermediate airports are going to be what you tend to think of as your municipal airport, just that local airport, still certainly valuable to the system. And then landing strips, some that are just turf runways where we see a lot of our ag spraying operations, those kinds of things. The federal money that we receive is from the Airport Improvement Program. Airports, we are a Channeling Act state, which means that the state acts as an agent for the airport, so the money comes through us to the airport. The airports decide which projects that they want to do. We have to approve them and recommend them up to the FAA for funding. There's basically two categories, if you will, of entitlement dollars that the airports receive. So of those 135 airports, and then as you get down to the 92 that are receiving entitlements, $150,000 a year in entitlements. And the way that works is the federal government would pay 90% of a project cost, and then the local would have to be 10%. And the federal government doesn't care if that's local, or if it's state dollars or whatever, they just know that it's not federal dollars. There's also a piece of the federal money that comes to Minnesota, that state apportionment. That's money that MnDOT gets to decide, or we can assign it to a project that's moving forward. A little bit about the AIP program. We've been working very hard this year to improve the federal spend, if you will. So each year when airports receive those entitlement dollars, they may not have a project. And so what happens to that money? Well, from the airport's perspective, they're allowed to bank it or roll it, carry it forward. So this year you don't have a project, that's okay. You can keep that money. Next year, instead of having $150,000, you would have $300,000. Now, the federal government doesn't just give you the money and let you put it in the bank, and they don't put it in the bank either. What they do with it is, nationwide, they have a deadline, and they tell all the airports around the country, you need to decide, are you spending your money or not? And then all the money that's left unspent, they transform that money, and it becomes discretionary. And then that money is competed for nationally. And so what we've been working on is that if you've been banking that money, in the fourth year it expires at sunset. So if you don't have a project in all of those years, the federal government starts saying, you know what, we're not going to let you keep carrying this on your books. That's going to go away. Well, when that money becomes discretionary, it could go anywhere. It could go to Texas. Heaven forbid, it could go to Wisconsin. You know, we want it to stay here in Minnesota. Airports have the ability to transfer those dollars to other airports in the state. And so this year we've been working really hard, and we've done a very good job. We call up an airport, say, hey, we see your dollars are going to expire. We know of this other airport that has a project. They need some money. Let's transfer it over. And so we've been working to broker those deals, and it's been very successful, helping us to improve the federal spend here in the state. The state airports program, the way we spend the state airports money for the grants that go to projects, we have various participation rates depending on the kind of project it is, and we tend to participate at a higher rate for those airports that are not eligible to receive federal money, because those airports, really the only financial resources they have would be state funding and then local funding, so they have fewer resources available to them. Each year we collect applications. The airports identify all their projects. We have a prioritization system. We rank the projects. We score them. We give them a numerical score based on a number of factors, and then we put them in a list. We look at how much money we have available, and then we draw a line. And so we start offering out those grants. Not every airport accepts the grants for a variety of reasons. Sometimes perhaps their environmental permits didn't come in. Perhaps they had some other issue at the local level. They needed to provide funding to a library or a park, so they just couldn't put their local money together. And so we just continue offering grants until we've hit that budget line. And I will say every year we never run out of projects below the line. There's always more projects at the and then if those that we didn't get to, we don't just toss them out. We keep them, and then they get put in the mix again the next year if the airport still wants to continue forward with that work. Here's our selection project process. So we look at the project purpose. So for example, is it a safety project? We look at the airport classification, that key intermediate landing strip, the component of the airport. We tend to, in highways, people tend to talk about spending money from the center line out. And with airports, we spend money airside needs first. So do we have a runway issue that's more important than an issue at a terminal? And so we tend to focus on those runway issues first, and then the type of project it is. And again, we offer grants to those highest priority ones. And then finally, when we did the state aviation system plan and we inventoried all of the airports, we looked at the condition of the airports and what it would take to bring them up to standards. The numbers that you see here do not include MSP. So this is all of the general aviation airports in the state, and some that have airline service as well. But the need for a 20-year period is a little over $2 billion, and the available state and federal funding to meet that need was $855 million. So there's certainly more need out there than there is revenue. And this, again, is in our aviation system plan, and with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Isaacson. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious about the one slide that talks about transferring monies and entitlements expire in fourth year. Do you ever allow monies to expire and go off to other airport states and stuff? Can't you find projects for them or something? Since we always seem so short of money for that anyway.
Ms. Isaacson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we've been working in the past. That has happened. Yes, airports have, because the airport is the, you know, we can't force someone, a community to spend money if they don't want to. And so they have allowed federal dollars to expire. One of our, and I don't know if there's been a lot of talk with you, MnDOT's working on some wildly important goals. And for our office, our wildly important goal this year was to stop allowing federal funds to expire. And so we've been going to those communities and brokering deals and saying, you know, we see that you're going to have some money expire. We want you to transfer that money to someone else. And they've all, as soon as, I think that at the local level, they did not necessarily, they're wanting to be responsible. They're, well, we don't have a project. We don't want to waste money. And so they want to turn it back. And so as we explained to them, that money is going to be spent on an airport. Congress, FAA has already decided that money's going to an airport. The question is, do you want it to go to a Minnesota airport or any airport out there? Once they hear that, they always want it to go to a Minnesota airport. So we've been very successful in helping communities to do that. I think some of them were just sort of unaware of that bigger picture.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the fourth slide there, Aviation of Minnesota, it indicates that there's 340 commercial operators in the state at this point. Is there a trend in, let's say, the past 10 years? Has that number gone up or down?
Mr. Chairman, I would say, yes, that trend has gone up and down. The reality is that, I mean, aviation is certainly a bumpy business. It tends to be sort of at the bleeding edge of the economy, if you will. And so aviation starts to feel things a lot of times before the rest of the economy does. Even prior to September 11th, aviation has started feeling a bit of a decline. And so September 11th certainly put it in the basement fairly quickly. And so we're seeing some of that, you know, we're hearing good things about some of the changes that were made a little over a year ago, particularly the elimination of sales tax on parts and labor. That's kind of generating some excitement and those kinds of things. So.
Okay. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I see those numbers? Let's say in the past 15 years, how many commercial operations there have been in the state of Minnesota? Is it possible to get those numbers?
Mr. Chair, we'll put something together for
thank
you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hausman, you have the last question.
Yes,
for
thank you, Mr. Chair. To the slide on page 4, is the Duluth Airport under your umbrella?
Ms. Isaacson.
Mr. Chairman, yes. So every public airport.
So because they're the one I know just recently would have finished a relatively major improvement program.
Okay.
Is that formula that it says generally 90% federal, 10% local, is that how the funding of that airport turned out, 90% 10? Or
Ms. Isaacson.
Do you know?
The funding for the terminal project at Duluth, there were, I think at one point, there were 17 different cash flows that we were working on. So there was a mix of state money, federal money, local money, bonding money. So all the way across the board, there was a different mix, and each one of those revenue streams has requirements with it. So for example, with the bond funds that airports would pursue, typically there's an amount in there, and it says that a certain percentage has to come from non-state sources. The state airports fund is a state source, so we have to track that as well. With that exact breakdown, do I have the percentage for you today? No, we could put that together and show you. But
since it said generally, I just
right.
Didn't know.
And that's why I said generally. It's because sometimes, especially for those larger, complex, multi-year, multi-revenue streams coming in, it's certainly challenging. We have some gigantic spreadsheets for the Duluth project.
Thank you, Ms. Isaacson. Thank you for being at the committee today. We're going to move on to the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and we have Mr. Killian, Director of Government Affairs. Okay. We also have Mr. Hamill. Will you be joining as well? You're more than welcome. Okay.
I may need it in a few minutes. We'll see what happens, Mr. Chairman. Thanks
for
the invitation.
Oh, this is Mr. Hamill. I'm sorry. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. Appreciate the invitation to give you kind of a background and a bit of information about the Metropolitan Airports Commission. My name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Executive Director and CEO of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and I've been in that capacity for a long time, about 3 decades. Pleasure to have us join you today. Let's see. I'll go through the slides. I believe you all have a copy in front of you, so I'll just fill in some of the more critical information. Throughout the course of the discussion today, I'm going to kind of demonstrate to you that the Metropolitan Airports Commission is a kind of a different form of government. And I'll just say, generally speaking, we generally operate more like a business than we do a government agency, and that's because we have the capacity to generate all of our own revenues and pay our own bills. And I'll talk in more detail about how we forecast our revenues, how we calculate and take a look at our expenses and balance our own budgets. The bottom line is, you hear me say it again later on, that we do not receive any public funds from the general fund or the state legislature. The monies that we have to operate the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and the other airports on our airport system are all funds generated by running our business and charging our customers fees, which they pay to generate the revenue supply or support for the Airports Commission's finances. We provide and promote safe, convenient, environmentally sound, cost-competitive aviation services for our customers. The customers are the traveling public and all the businesses that depend on traveling needs as part of the of their activities and the needs of the, all residents of the state of Minnesota. MAC is a public corporation. Basically, we're the first commission created by this body in 1943. It was a pretty enlightened legislature at that time, along with the Governor Harold Stassen, who believed that our geographic location in North America led us to be a natural stopover point and an easy nonstop to almost every departure point, destination point in North America, including Canada. And that's proven over the course of the years to be true. And Northwest Airways, back in the 1920s, 1928 and forward, thought exactly the same thing. And as a result, Northwest Airways was located in the Twin Cities. And that's what grew into Northwest Airlines, which ultimately became Delta Airlines. So it's a very, very good story. MAC owns and operates seven airports in the system. We do have, however, jurisdictional responsibility for two 35-mile radiuses, one centered over Minneapolis City Hall and St. Paul City Hall, so they kind of overlap a bit. But that 35-mile radius incorporates all the land within the seven-county metropolitan area and portions of counties, six additional counties outside the ring but close to the Twin Cities. Technically, I suppose we do have the authority to manage and control all of the airports located in that within those boundaries. We do not. We choose to operate and manage six airports, with MSP being the most visible, most obvious airport. And then we have six general aviation airports that I'll talk about in a few minutes. I've already pointed to this, but the fact is that the Airports Commission operates on a user fee basis. If you use our airport, if you buy an airline ticket, if you come to the airport and you park your car, you will pay a fee for the services that you use. That's true of the airline companies and all the folks who generate revenue in the airport. They also pay the Airports Commission for the use of our facilities. And I'll get into significantly more detail in a few moments. We do have a limited property taxing authority given to us by you. It's a one-third of a mill on all the real property of the Twin Cities metropolitan area. We have not exercised that tax since the early to mid-1960s, and I will tell you that all of our financial planning and all of our forecasting and so forth is predicated upon never activating or using that tax. However, it does have a benefit in that when the rating agencies take a look at the Metropolitan Airports Commission, they notice that we've not exercised it since the mid-1960s, but they see that a one-third mill is available to us. If we were to run into some sort of jeopardy, we could rely or fall back upon that, and as a result, we enjoy the highest rating of any, the highest category of rating for airports in the United States. And there are about four or five large hubs that enjoy a similar rating to ours. The board is appointed primarily by the governor of the state of Minnesota. Our chairman, Dan Boven, who is also a board member since 2003, was appointed by Governor Dayton during his first term. The chairman of our board serves at the pleasure of the governor. So when the governor is changed, the chairman of the board changes essentially. The governor also appoints 12 of our commissioners. Eight commissioners who reside in the seven-county metropolitan area. What the MAC does with its districts, we combine two Met Council districts to form one MAC district. So there are 16 Met Council districts. There are eight MAC districts in the metro area. And those commissioners serve on staggered terms for 4 years. So once appointed, they stay appointed regardless of the change of the governor's office and various election cycles. We also have four outstate board members, one from Marshall, Minnesota, one from Rochester, one from St. Cloud, and one from Duluth. Those cities do not necessarily always send a commissioner. The governor decides based on the category of airports across the state who those four outstate commissioners would be. And then both the mayor of Minneapolis and the mayor of St. Paul have seats on our board. Neither mayor personally sits on the board, but it represents sits on their behalf. It's proven to be an extremely stable and a very, very effective overall board. I will tell you that from an observation standpoint, people who are appointed to our board read the agendas, read the materials, routinely contact staff, tour airports, get involved in issues at a very, very detailed level. It's a very active board. And we have stability because they're not elected officials, because they're appointed, and they're appointed for four-year terms. When one party leaves office, for example, Governor Plenty left office and Governor Dayton came in, we maintain the stability of our planning because, quite frankly, what you'll learn is the Airports Commission spends a lot of money on large, large projects. and we can't start a project and stop because of a different persuasion coming into office. We have to complete the things that we do, and part of that is responding to the needs of the business community that we serve. The airlines need quick response, quick action, quick investment. And if they can, in fact, can convince the Airports Commission that the investment's necessary, whatever it may be, expansion of the airport, some runway activities, railway systems, whatever the case may be, that stability of having commissioners stay in office for 4 years and continue to maintain that stable decision-making process and educate newer appointed commissioners works out extremely well. This is our structure. I'm not going to talk a great deal about it. You are our boss. I report to you on behalf of our board. Our commissioners may come to you from time to time, and our chair may come to you from time to time, but primarily I'm the contact along with Mitchell Killian, who's our legislative affairs representative both at the state level and at the federal level. The commission has three committees, a finance and administration committee, a planning, development, and environment committee, and a management and operations committee. That's the role of the commissioners as far as policymakers and decision makers on our board. I serve as the CEO of the organization, and Dennis Probst is executive vice president, who is with us again today as well. We have divided the organization into kind of an overall management philosophy, with my being in charge of the performance of the organization, and Dennis basically operates as the chief operating officer with the various departments and divisions. The MAC system of airports. We have the largest system of airports in the United States, about 360 to 375,000 aircraft takeoff and land in our system outside of MSP. We own six airports. St. Paul Downtown Airport is an intermediate airport designed for corporate aviation use primarily. That means its runways are longer than 5,000 feet, but not long enough to sustain regular air carrier-sized aircraft. St. Paul Downtown is the home of United Health. It's the home of 3M Aviation. A variety of corporate names you would recognize are stationed at St. Paul Downtown. On the east metro area is Lake Elmo Airport, a small recreational airport for single and twin-engine propeller aircraft. To the north is Anoka County Airport, an airport that has a 5,000-foot runway and can accommodate probably 85 to 90% of all corporate jets, could not sustain the operation of a large air carrier operation, and it serves the needs of recreational pilots and small business operators as well. Northwest corner, Crystal Airport, again a smaller airport, single and twin-engine prop aircraft, short runways, purely recreational and small business users. In the southwest corner, Eden Prairie, the Flying Cloud Airport, a 5,000-foot runway, similar to Anoka County, can handle most of the corporate jets that are produced in America and flown by corporations, but primarily used by small business operators, flight schools, and recreational flyers. Then to the south is the Ear Lake Airport down in Lakeville, about a 4,000-foot runway, handles an occasional light jet aircraft, but mostly recreational and small business propeller aircraft. The system is recognized across the country as large compared to most communities, metropolitan areas, operated by one airport authority, which means that we basically apply our policies across the entire system in the Twin Cities. We call these airports relievers because what they do is provide operators of aircraft a choice. Rather than have everyone come into MSP, which contributes to congestion, we've designed MSP for large air carrier operations of 8 to 11,000-foot runways for virtually any airline that can produce in the world. But we preserve capacity by giving alternative airports for aircraft that don't require 8 to 11,000 feet. And what that does is let a business person coming from Chicago flying his or her own aircraft, if they have business in the North Metro, they can fly into Anoka County Airport, park the airplane there, receive maintenance and services, and then fly back and not disrupt the activity at MSP and get into the mix of the larger air carrier operation. It's a very successful model. We're pretty conservative when it comes to our financial management. Part of that is because we can be, and secondly, because it makes sense due to the fact that there's no backstop for us. If we should miscalculate our forecasting and make a mistake, the only place we can go is to our reserves that we have invested and or go to short-term financing, commercial paper or whatever. That has worked well for us. We always do run a small surplus. That surplus is reinvested in subsequent years to handle and deal with various projects and programs on the airport. Our model is based on half of the people who use our airport. You have to understand that 50% of the total passenger load are people who originate or Minneapolis is their destination. So they want to be and are purposely in the Twin Cities, either departing the Twin Cities or returning to the Twin Cities for business purposes. That's half the traffic. The other half of the traffic are connecting passengers, individual departing Boston, well, not today. How about maybe New York, Washington, D.C., through Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Delta en route to Seattle. That's a connecting passenger. We predicate all of our financial forecasting and our revenue generation based only on the origination destination traffic, people who want to be in the Twin Cities to conduct business or who live here. We do that because the connecting traffic is vulnerable to the decision of an airline company. Delta Airlines could decide that they want to downsize their connecting traffic through Minneapolis-St. Paul and run it through Detroit or Salt Lake City instead. We would have no control over that, nor would we have planned for it. So we generate our revenues, and we forecast our activities and our revenue source based on the traffic that's demanded by people using our airport for business and for personal pleasure flying. We maintain a six-month reserve of cash on hand. That lets us be secure in the fact that we've got 6 months to solve the problems if we run into a difficulty with a significant drop in our revenues. We enjoy a AA-minus bond rating. No other airport in the nation has a higher bond rating. A couple have the same bond rating, but most have a rating slightly below ours or substantially below ours, depending on the size of the operation. And our airline cost per plane passenger, this is what it costs an airline, such as Delta, to transfer or to take a person from the, through the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport for departure, arrivals, or pass a passenger through the facility. And that cost I'll show you in just a few moments. But we are extremely competitive as an airport, and the airlines who serve Minneapolis-St. Paul enjoy low cost. Cost per plane passenger. This is difficult to see. I'll just give you the highlights. At the top of the diagram is Washington Dulles Airport, Kennedy, Newark, and Miami. Those airports, the cost to an airline company to transfer a passenger through that facility is between $25 and $30 at the top of the range. At the mid-range point, it's about $11.50, $11.75 per passenger. If you can see it behind me, the actual cost is $6.68 for Minneapolis-St. Paul. And the lowest cost airports, I can't explain Charlotte Douglas at 94 cents, but typically the low is around $4 to $6. That puts us in the lower one-third, and actually we're one position above being in the bottom quarter. We're the only airport in the top that has to plow snow, that has to deal with pretty adverse weather conditions, and as a result, we're pretty proud of our workforce for the way we maintain and operate the airport in a safe and well-maintained operation. We have one of the lowest delayed rates because of weather phenomenon in the country. All the airports at the top, with the exception of Salt Lake City, have no snow to deal with. And just to put that in perspective, we have 450 pieces of snow removal equipment on the airport. Average cost about $400,000 per piece. Multiply that and you can see we've got tens of millions of dollars invested in equipment to make sure the airport's operated safely. All the folks at the top don't have to have that expenditure, so we're pretty pleased with these numbers. Let's talk about MAC finances for a bit. We forecast our revenues. How do we make our money? We're projecting in 2015 that we'll generate $303 million. We charge the airline companies a landing fee based on the weight of the airplane that's landed. It's about $1.50 per 1,000 pounds of landed weight. What that means is that a typical airliner pays somewhere in the area about $400 to land at the airport. We also charge the airline company a fee to park at the gate. We charge them a fee to use the gate hold space. We charge them a common use fee to walk up and down our concourses with their passengers. We charge them for ticket counters, baggage carousels, storage space, office space, and hangars. We own most all the hangars and all the buildings at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. We build them at our expense to encourage investment by the airlines. They can focus on passengers and purchasing airplanes. We'll focus on the infrastructure that supports the operation, and they'll pay us back over the course of 30 or 40 years. When those bonds are retired, we continue to charge the airlines a fee for using those facilities to build up a pool to build replacement hangars and facilities as time requires. That's the airline side or the business side. Another part of aspect of business is that we charge all of the concessionaires in the terminal building fees. We charge a percentage of their gross sales. We charge them for the square footage that they occupy in the terminal building to present their goods for service. Whether it's food and beverage or retail sales, everyone who's in the building generating revenue or making a living pays a fee to the Airports Commission. Operating expenses, about $164 million a year. Gross debt service, about $128 million a year. Our current outstanding debt is about $1.5 billion, down from 2.3 10 years ago when we expanded the airport the last time, built the new runways on the airport, put in the LRT, and expanded concourses. It's a financial model that talks about real big dollars for an agency of our size, but the fact of the matter is that it's a balanced model. We manage it very conservatively and very carefully, and we always end up with a surplus at year-end. That surplus then goes into next year's capital improvements on the airport. We also use surpluses to leverage bonding and bond sales and to leverage investment on the airport as well. How do we rank? Minneapolis-St. Paul is the seventh busiest airport when you take a look at total passengers. That number may be off by one or two places. because the numbers fluctuate year to year. But as of 2013, that was number 17. 2014, we reached a higher level of passenger activity. Wouldn't surprise me to be 15th or 16th when the numbers come out to the year end 14. And we're the 11th busiest airport in operations in the United States. That number will change because we're watching a trend develop now where we're having fewer and fewer operations, and I'll show you some data on that in a few moments. And we're the second largest hub in the Delta Airlines system. What do people say about us? A couple things are kind of interesting. First of all, the first block talks about the Air Transport Research Society. This is a department at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver. Professor Wam, about 20 years ago, started a survey through his research and focusing on aviation and airports of the world. And he divided the world into five pieces. There's a North American segment. In North America, Minneapolis-St. Paul was ranked by Professor Quam and his rating team as the most efficiently operated airport in North America. The survey is done every 3 years. We've never ranked number one. We've always ranked in the top three. But I was surprised this time because Delta and their hub operation in Atlanta and the Atlanta airport, because of no snow operations, normally ranks the most efficient airport in North America. So I was very surprised and pleased that we became number one in 13. They'll do the survey again in 2016. We'll see what happens. Hopefully we'll stay where we are. We're also voted as the best food and beverage program in North America in 2013 by Airports Council International. That was a surprise because our food and beverage program is 10 years old and now up for rebid, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But it's an older program, but one that still very much realizes being a very strong program by travelers. Best overall airport concessions program by Airport Revenue News in 2014. Airport with the most new routes, and third best airport in North America by Travel and Leisure magazine. By the way, last year Travel and Leisure has ranked as number one. We don't know what happened, but it's important to be in the top three. We get good accolades, and those accolades come to us because I honestly believe I have an extraordinary staff. I have the best snowplow operation, the best maintenance people, the best finance people, the best legal team, the best lobbying team in the legislature of any airport in the country. That's true. Air service success measures. As you all know, Delta Airlines is about 75% of our total operation. They are the primary carrier in Minneapolis-St. Paul, providing the largest share of nonstop destination service to all parts of the country and international destinations. However, we've been challenged by Governor Dayton during his first term to generate as much competition as we can in the market. So since 2008, we have been out recruiting airlines more aggressively. We've always been recruiting, but more aggressively. 2008, Alaska Air started serving Minneapolis, St. Paul to Seattle and up to Alaska. Southwest Airlines entered our market in 2009. Great Lakes, which is a twin-engine prop, turboprop operation of 19 passenger airplanes, started in 2011. Spirit hit our market with Aurora in 2012. After two short years, they transport almost 750,000 Minnesotans a year on the ultra-low-cost carrier that serves Minneapolis, St. Paul. Air France started service in 2013 on a seasonal basis, and Condor started seasonal service in 2014. So we've seen a growth of competitive services and price competition in the marketplace to the point where Delta's gone from about 80-81% down to about 75% of our total operation. This truly does give people a choice when they go into the system and look for the lowest fare to their destination. We also encourage new investment on international air service by providing incentive fees. We will cover some advertising fees and some operational expenses will be deferred if they start new international service and provide that service for at least a year. Passenger history has fluctuated. The peak passenger level was in 2005 when we hit about 37.8 million passengers. Then what happened that year was the filing of bankruptcy of Northwest Airlines, the downsizing of the airline, and the ceasing of routes that did not produce positive revenues. We also saw the beginning of a declining economy, and so by 2009 we collapsed down to somewhere in the vicinity of about 32.2, 32.3 million passengers. That's a substantial amount of money lost for us and a significant impact. However, we did believe that the growth that we saw up through 2005 was a bit artificial. We actually began planning for a slowdown or a decline in our passenger levels, and in fact we're prepared for this when it happened without anticipating the recession. Since that time, we've seen steady and stable growth. I would tell you that the growth is much stronger, much more long-term and better established. We've now grown back up to about 35 million passengers year-end 2014. And that's a fairly realistic number. We'll grow at about 2.25% per year looking forward for the next 5 to 10 years. By the way, the forecast passenger growth in Minneapolis we're going to grow from the current 35 million passengers to over 50 million by 2030. So about 14 years from now, we'll be significantly larger. That's a concern for people who live near the airport. I've got another figure I want to show you, and that's overall aircraft operations. Operations were reached a high in 2004 of about 535,000 takeoffs and landings. That's now dropped down to just about 400,000 takeoffs and landings. That's 135,000 fewer flights today than we had 10 years ago. How does that happen? We have growing passenger levels, and we're forecasting continued growth, but operations are dropping. What's happening is we're seeing a decrease in the number of smaller regional jets that are being retired from the fleets because they're not economical. So the 50-passenger airplanes will disappear. Higher capacity mainline airplanes will come in larger numbers. And what's happening is as the passenger traffic grows, higher capacity airplanes, more seats are available in the market. As a result, you can move more people with fewer flights. And the good news environmentally is that the newer flights are being flown by newer airplanes that consume 25 to 30% less fuel and significantly less noise. So the balance of the equation here works very, very well, and we forecast being able to meet the need of about 50 million passengers with some modest increase in operations, but not going back up to the levels above 535,000 until sometime past 2030. The industry itself, as you all probably know, is in a consolidation phase. Northwest Airlines was acquired by Delta Airlines, headquarters moved to Atlanta, Georgia. Continental was acquired by United and became United Airlines. Air Trans just finished its merger with Southwest, and now Southwest owns and operates the Air Trans system. And we're looking at the final stages of the U.S. Airlines being absorbed by American Airlines to form the new American Airlines. Essentially what that means is that we're returning to a profitable airline industry. The key here is that they've moved from market share models where airlines dominated markets like Minneapolis, St. Paul with Northwest for many, many years and Delta to saying we don't care so much about market share dominance. We want to take a look at our shareholder equity. We want to generate more profits. During the last several years, you've seen all of the major carriers basically shedding themselves of routes that are not profitable. So if, for example, Delta Airlines cannot be profitable on a route from International Falls to Minneapolis-St. Paul, and then from Minneapolis-St. Paul to Washington, D.C., they've dropped the service from International Falls. They've relegated that to regional carriers, partners of the primary carrier, and where that doesn't work and generate profits, they simply discontinue the service. We have lost service to Minneapolis-St. Paul, and we've lost substantial service throughout the upper Midwest. But the bottom line is that this is the first time that the airlines have established a model based on shareholder equity and profitability. Delta Airlines is showing a $3 billion profit this year. Revenue is higher than they've ever experienced before. The big four airlines basically are making a great deal of money. They will show and earn $10 billion or more, the four of them combined. And they're looking at revenues in 2015 of in excess of $15 billion in profitability. The profits are driven by, quite frankly, disciplined capacity control. They're right-sizing airplanes to the market. They're not putting a 50-passenger airplane into a 20-passenger market. They're not putting 115-passenger airplanes into a 50-passenger market. They either have the airplane that fits the market or they don't provide the service. They're using newer, right-sized airplanes that have less environmental impact and are much more cost-efficient. The demand for travel is now growing again significantly. Fuel costs are at a significantly lower level. We're all aware of that. And, of course, ancillary revenues. The airlines generate $7 billion a year in revenue by charging you for where you sit, the bag that you check, and other amenities you enjoy on the airplane. Near-term challenges for MSP, this is important to all of us to be aware of. We have congested terminal space in Terminal 1. The queuing lines are getting longer, and the space to accommodate passengers and to process people more quickly is challenging. Inefficient security checkpoints. We now have six security checkpoints that take you from the ticketing side into the secured side to go to your gate. That is not a very efficient operation, and we got significant plans to alter that, and I'll explain that in a moment. We have insufficient parking in Terminal 1. If you come out to the airport on any Tuesday or Wednesday morning, you may very likely run into our team blocking off the entrance into the parking facilities at Terminal 1, Lindbergh Terminal, and sending you over to the Humphrey Terminal, Terminal 2, to park your vehicle and then take the LRT from T2 back to T1. What that means for most travelers, if you're pushing the clock, you're probably going to miss your connection because it's probably about a 30, 35, 40-minute voyage to go from T1's parking ramp out of the ramp over to T2 and then catch the LRT coming back. So we have plans to deal with that problem as well, and I'll discuss that in a moment. All of the leases in T1 and T2 are going to expire over the next 2 years, a large chunk in 2015, another large significant amount in 2017. We're dealing with that at the present time. And we have capacity constraints. T2, which was criticized as being an overbuilt kind of a palace, is now exceeding its capacity significantly, and it's grown from a couple 100,000 passengers a year 15, 12 years ago to over 4 million passengers a year using that facility. So what plans do we have in 2015 to meet some of these needs? We are consolidating checkpoints 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 5 into one large checkpoint, so that we'll have two major checkpoints to process passengers. We're expanding them to between 6 and 10 processing aisles, and the TSA is working with us cooperatively to try to work on the most efficient way of operating our checkpoints. So when you walk in the building, you'll see terminal or checkpoint 1 and checkpoint 2. You'll go to the north or the south end of the terminal building in T1 to be processed, and we believe it'll be a significant improvement in efficiency and long lines but shorter processing time. We are rebidding all most of our retail sales. All of our retail sales and most of and so, let me say that again. We're going to rebid all of our retail sales because of expiring leases in 2015, and some of our food and beverage, and we'll do the rest of the food and beverage in 2017. Just to put this in perspective, 10 years ago we initiated a new model within the airport industry to create batches that would be competitively bid against by a variety of providers. What we wanted to do was have multiple operators in the building competing with one another, as opposed to having one large bidder take over the entire terminal concessions program, which was historically the traditional model. Ten years ago, when we created this, it caused havoc in the industry, but at the end of the day, we ended up with four providers of major concessions. And what that means is that four different companies parsed out portions of the gate hold spaces, the concourses, and the main terminal building, and found themselves competing with one another. And what that gave us was increased customer service, some price control and competition, and a better overall quality of the product being sold in the terminal. Today, the road warriors, who spend a lot of time in airports, can purchase clothing items such as a suit, and they do. They purchase shoes en route because the pricing in the airport is controlled by the airport. Street pricing plus 10% is as high as it can go. So you don't feel as if you're being taken advantage of as a captive person in an airport terminal when you travel a great deal. So we're working on that one right now, and those bids are going out in the next couple of weeks. By the way, the revenue generated from that program, gross revenue is about $185 million. It will grow with the new program to about $225 million. Today, MAC generates about $21 to $22 million off of that gross concessions program as part of their fees paid to us to support the overall operation of the MAC. We're doing a three-gate expansion at the Humphrey Terminal Building. Actually, going to put four jet bridges on three gate positions. That begins this summer. We'll be done in about 16 or 18 months to provide more capacity at T2 to accommodate Sun Country's growth, Southwest growth, and any other carriers over in that facility. We have a new parking option for you. Because the parking ramps fill up on Tuesdays and Thursday mornings, we have an employee parking ramp that was at the end of the Northwest Airlines, the old Northwest, now Delta hangar on the inbound roadway to Terminal 1. We've taken that parking facility back. It can accommodate 1,400 vehicles. We're providing what we call the quick ride ramp, where you can park your car on that ramp, and we'll have a shuttle bus running from that ramp frequently back and forth between that ramp and the terminal building. So it's kind of a car door to the front door of the terminal building to pick up the slack while we make decisions on when to begin construction of a new ramp on the inbound roadway at the airport. And finally, we're looking at a new hotel being built on the airport. It will be the first hotel in the airport. Customers ask for it regularly and frequently. Hoteliers believe that it's got high potential. We're talking with the final list now is two bidders that want to propose to us the construction of probably about a 250 to 300 room hotel. It would be in the four-star range, about $250 a night. And the hoteliers have looked at the demographics and the numbers believe that this thing will serve the needs of the traveling public and will be filled much of the time. Wrapping up with a little bit of economic impact. Metro Airports Commission's 3,400 acres of property generate in excess of $10 billion of revenue to the Twin Cities metropolitan area in the state of Minnesota. To put that in perspective, we know of no other piece of real estate between Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Seattle, and as far south as St. Louis, that generates and contributes anywhere near $10 billion a year. It is a substantial amount of income. We basically, I'll break this down for you a little bit with more important numbers. 76,000 people generate some portion of their revenue through their job providing services to the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. Of that 76,000 people, a little under 2,000, 19,800 people actually come to the airport every day and go to work. Of that 20,000 people who work at the airport every day, the totality of the Metropolitan Airports Commission staff, which includes our police department, our fire department, our complete field maintenance and public works department, our administrative staff, our finance folks, our ops people, our administration, our leadership, consists of fewer than 600 total employees. So we're a small part of the workforce on the airport. But the salaries paid, the spending by travelers is substantially contributing to the economy of the region. Tax revenues generated by the airport, total impact about $611 million a year, of which about $358 million goes to the federal government, $243 million goes to the state revenue stream, and about another $10 million goes into local tax revenues adjacent to the airport. What I've done is giving you a snapshot of the airport in a very short order. It kind of gives you a sense of kind of the encapsulated model of more of a business working relationship, the way we generate revenues and the way we spend our dollars, how we plan our development construction, and kind of our plans for 2015 and meeting the needs of travelers. Happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. That was a very well-prepared presentation. We appreciate the professionalism there. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just intrigued by, on page 9, the slide 2015 improvement highlights. Seems sort of counterintuitive, consolidation of security checkpoints 1 through 4 into a single checkpoint, and it would be improved?
It would be two checkpoints, one on the north end, one on the south end of the terminal building, representative. And basically, we now have a newly consolidated checkpoint number 1 on the south end of the terminal building. And if you watch, the lines are long, but if you stand in line and watch, when we do this, by the way, we have people actually have a stopwatch. We'll watch a person get into the longer line at checkpoint, the new expanded checkpoint 1, and we'll watch a person in a shorter line, and that person in the longer line will be processed through and finished before the other person even gets to the counter to be screened. We believe that the efficiencies that we can demonstrate today with the current Rapids system can be significantly improved in the current process. We expect it to drop down to 10 to 12 minutes per passenger screening.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give about 3 sentences on your relationship with the FAA and who controls what here?
I'll be very, very brief, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Earhart. Our Representative Earhart. The FAA controls the movement of aircraft on the ground and in the air. The airport has no authority over that. They decide what runways are to be used. They decide the time that the schedules are. They approve and clear the flight plans, but they're the air traffic controllers and the ground controllers. So when you want to move an airplane, the FAA takes care of that. Airlines decide what airplanes are going to be flown in the marketplace, the charge for fares, and essentially where those airplanes are going to fly to and how frequently. And they also determine the type of equipment that you'll be riding on. So those are the two major components. The airport authority should be looked at as primarily a landlord. We build the physical infrastructure on the ground that provides an accommodation to have the FAA have controlling space and run their operations for a safe operation, and the airlines have facilities to use to transfer passengers. So it's kind of a three-piece. FAA, air traffic control, airlines running the airline company, and we running the physical plant in our community.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hamill. And members, I apologize, but we do have to be respectful of the next committee coming in, so we do need to wrap this up. And thank you for being here and sharing this with the committee today. Appreciate
it. Thanks for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, and we look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you. Members, next meeting is Monday the 2nd. We'll be in room 5 with a couple of overviews, one of Met Council, the County Transit Board, and Suburban Transit. So we will see you Monday. Thank you for your time. This meeting is adjourned.